the notion I had when I was in high school was that the Viet Cong terrorized the Vietnamese population, forced them to fight against the Americans on pain of death. What I began to understand in Vietnam was that they didn't need to do things like that. All they had to do was let a Marine patrol go through a village, and whatever was left of that village, they had all the recruits that they needed.
Welcome to Current Affairs. My name is Nathan Robinson. I am the editor-in-chief of Current Affairs magazine. Today we will be speaking with Dr. W.D. Ehrhardt. He is an award-winning poet, scholar, and teacher of history and literature. He has worked in his life as everything from a forklift operator to a newspaper reporter to a merchant seaman. He has written on a broad range of subjects, but a great deal of his work is informed by his experience in Vietnam in the United States Marine Corps. His collected poetry is found in the book, Thank You for Your Service, and he is also the author of several volumes of memoirs about both his first-person observations of the Vietnam War and his life after returning, including his participation in the Vietnam Veterans Against the War movement. Dr. Ehrhardt, thank you so much for joining us on Current Affairs.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you for having me.
I want to start, well, perhaps we could start with a poem. I was wondering if you could read us your poem, your poem, Song for Leela, Bobby, and Me.
Sure. The poem is Song for Leela, Bobby, and Me. Leela is my daughter, who is now 35, but who at the time was barely a toddler. Bobby is a man named Robert Ross, and he is actually the person I'm speaking to in the poem. He's the you in the poem. Mm-hmm. So here we go. Song for Leela, Bobby, and Me. The day you flew to Tam Kỳ, I was green with envy. Not that lifeless, washed-out green of sun-bleached, dusty jungle utes. I was rice shoot green, teenage green. This wasn't going to be just one more chicken shit guerrilla fight. Farmers, women, booby traps and snipers, dead Marines, and not a Viet Cong in sight. This was hardcore NVA, a regiment at least. But someone had to stay behind, man the bunker, plot the H&I. I have friends who wonder why I can't just let the past lie where it lies, why I'm still so angry. As if there's something wrong with me, as if the life you might have lived were just a fiction, just a dream, as if those California dawns were just as promising without you, as if the rest of us can get along just as well without you. Since you've been gone, they've taken boys like you and me and killed them in Grenada, Lebanon, the Persian Gulf, and Panama, Afghanistan, Somalia, Iraq. Yet, I'm told, I'm living in the past. Maybe that's the trouble. We're a nation with no sense of history. No sense at all. I still have that photo of you standing by the bunker door, smiling shyly, rifle, helmet, cigarette, green uniform. You hadn't been there long enough to fade. Somewhere in an album I don't have to look at anymore. I already know you just keep getting younger. In the middle of this poem, my daughter woke up crying. I lay down beside her, softly singing. Soon she drifted back to sleep. But I kept singing anyway. I wanted you to hear.
Thank you so much for that. In this conversation, I want to do a little bit to try and get us back in touch with that sense of history that, as you point out, we so very much lack in this country. And I hope that in doing so, we can start by going back to the beginning, to your upbringing in Pennsylvania, in small town Pennsylvania, in a town where you you know, you campaigned for Barry Goldwater and you, you know, and you, you know, you waved the flag in the Memorial Day parade and Elvis Presley was a scandal. Perhaps you could paint a little picture of that time and how you felt about the country. Take us back to that that time and place before you ended up in Vietnam.
Well, I don't know. You kind of pretty well captured it there.
Hear the word from this rockin' bird, Joe Niagara. May we present Lee Andrews and the Hearts to bring us home.
You know, it was good old small town America, southeastern Pennsylvania, it's suburbia now, but at the time, half my classmates in high school and growing up were farmers' kids, and so it was very rural. The town itself had 5,000 people. My father was a minister, a Protestant minister, and therefore pretty prominent in the community. I had two older brothers and then a brother who's somewhat younger than me. And of course, there was almost no real poverty, and there was not anything you could call real wealth. I mean, the wealthy people lived up on Ridge Road, and they were like the hospital administrator and the lawyer and people like that. But it wasn't the kind of wealth that we think of as, you know, really like people rolling in dough. Yeah, people like that didn't live in Perkasie. So it was it was all white, very homogenous. We had about three Jewish families in town, and we thought we were really liberal. I didn't really know a black person. Had met a few on rare occasions, not in Perkasie. I didn't have a black friend until I joined the Marine Corps, and I was 17 years old at that point. So it was also very Republican. I think my parents were actually Roosevelt Democrats, but they didn't make a big show of it. And of course, you know, I was born only a few years after the Second World War. Every Memorial Day, all of the fathers of my friends would get dressed up and march around on Memorial Day in their American Legion uniforms. And it was very, very traditional America. My first memory of television was of Russian tanks in the streets of Budapest in 1956.
Where a Catholic church once stood, an enormous statue of Stalin now towers over the scene in Budapest.
As Hungarian remember Nikita Khrushchev banging his shoe on the podium at the UN, shouting, "We will bury you." And I woke up one morning and the commies had built a wall right across the city of Berlin, literally overnight. I lived through the Cuban Missile Crisis. So when Lyndon Johnson said, "If we do not stop the communists in Vietnam, we will one day have to fight them on the sands of Waikiki," all this seemed perfectly, you know, I had no reason to question any of that. I remember standing out on my front lawn in 1957 and watching this little white light go across the sky every 90 minutes. That was Sputnik in 1957, and now the Russians could nuke us. They had missiles. So, you know, all of this stuff creates a vision of the world that was very much the Cold War, we're the good guys, they're the bad guys. John Kennedy becomes the president. Ask not what your country can do for you, and we will bear any burden, pay any price. And all of that sounded great.
Wayside, this is Situation Room. I read from the AP bulletin, Kennedy apparently shot in head. He fell face down in back seat of his car.
When Kennedy was murdered, my oldest brother and I drove down to Washington, D.C., and we stood for 8 hours in freezing late November weather, totally underdressed, stood there all night long from 10 at night till 6 in the morning just to walk through the Capitol Rotunda and see that closed casket. And when I walked through there, I cried. I mean, this is, you know, my country was the finest thing that God had ever put on earth. It was that simple. And when I joined the Marines, for a combination of very personal reasons and truly patriotic reasons, I believed I was doing God's work.
In your memoir, you quote this this remarkable editorial you wrote for the school newspaper right before you joined the Marines about Vietnam, where you put, where the war had started to be protests, and you said, you know, there are those who say that we're fighting a war to liberate a people who do not wish to be liberated, but you said, you know, we don't believe that, or, you know, we believe in the freedom of the Vietnamese people, and you weren't drafted, you signed up for the Marines out of a real sense of idealism.
I was too young to register for the draft. That's how young I was. I was 17 when I joined. My parents had to sign the enlistment contract because I was not yet 18. They were not too keen about doing that, not because they had any objections about the war. I mean, they believed the same things about America that I believed. That's where I got my beliefs from. Ultimately, that's where you end up being a mirror of your parents and your community. So, but they thought, you know, who... We have a son who can go to college, has been accepted at four different colleges, but he's going to go into the Marines in the middle of a war? Well, what mother wants that?
Right.
But I finally, and I don't remember this. My mother told me this when I was well into my 20s. After a long, anguished conversation, which I do remember, I said to her, "Is this the way you raised me, to let other mothers' sons fight America's wars?" And my mother said, "What could I say? How could she answer that? That's not the way she raised me." So she signed the papers. When I came back a couple of years later as a freaking fucked up Six Ways to Sunday, am I allowed to say that on your podcast?
You can say it. Actually, yes.
you can bleep that out. Anyway, you know, I came back pretty messed up and stayed that way for a long time. And I'm sure that my mother often thought, you know, would things have been different if she hadn't signed the paper? But the thing is, I would have spent that whole summer of 1966 making her life miserable, and I would have joined the Marines the day I turned 18 in September. So ultimately, she had little choice.
A great deal of your writing is about the process of the shattering of that worldview that you grew up with, that simple story of America. Do you remember the first time? Not that your illusions about the country were necessarily shattered, but when you joined the Marines. Do you remember the first moment at which things began to seem strange or unexpected? I mean, was it the brutality of training, or did it did everything seem normal then? And it wasn't until you got to Vietnam itself.
Actually, training was not. There's a real misconception about Marine boot camp that it's this brutal thing, and in fact, it was. I look back on it now and have for all of my adult life, amazed at how carefully programmed it was. I got to Vietnam. I was sent to this infantry battalion. I was in the intelligence section of an infantry battalion. And 3 days after I got there, the S2, the intelligence section, we handled prisoners and detainees and stuff like that. The rifle companies, one of the rifle companies was sending in a bunch of detainees. And detainees are civilians detained for questioning. And there's a whole different set of rules for how you're supposed to handle detainees. They're not prisoners of war, who are combatants caught in, you know, the act of fighting. So this guy I'm supposed to replace, this corporal who's like a year older than me, we get out of the amphibious tractor park to meet these two tractors coming in. And I can see there's a bunch of Vietnamese on top. And as the tractors pull into the park, the Marines up on top start throwing these people down. Now, these amphibious tractors are flat-topped boxes that are, I don't know, maybe 8 feet off the ground, the tops of them. And they start throwing these people off and kicking them off. And they're tied hand and foot. They can't break their fall. They're screaming. You can literally, at one point here, I heard bones either snapping or dislocating. People are screaming. And I'm, you know, I'm been in Vietnam for 3 days, and I'm looking at this corporal going, Jimmy, what are these guys doing? These are detainees. These are not prisoners. And he turns to me with the coldest, flattest voice I've ever heard in my life. And he looks at my arms. I'm grabbing his bicep with both hands. He looks at my hands on his arm, and he looks at my face, and he looks down at my arm again, and he looks up at my face, and he says, Earhart, better keep your mouth shut till you understand what's going on around here. And I just went, oh. That was the point at which I first started thinking, what the hell is going on here? This ain't what I was.
Yeah.
This is not quite what I signed up for. Well, within 4 months, I was one of the Marines up on top of those tractors throwing people off. I had run out of, within 4 months, I could not think of a single reason why I was in Vietnam, except to stay alive until March 1968, and then I could go home. Every possible explanation I could come up with for what I was doing there had come up empty. There was just no way to make any sense of it. It was all nuts. And I didn't want to be there, and I didn't want to die there. I was out on an operation, digging in for the night, and the battalion chaplain came by, and I had early on had been going to chapel, and he came by and said, you know, why aren't you, you I haven't seen you lately. What's going on? Ultimately, I told him that I had, you know, all sorts of reservations about what I was doing and what the hell are you doing here anyway? You're supposed to represent the Prince of Peace, blah, blah, blah. It was a hell of a conversation. But finally, he says, you know, there's such a thing as a conscientious objector's discharge. And I will help you with that if you want. Well, my reaction was, oh, no, you ain't hanging that albatross around my neck. CO is the first two letters of coward, as far as I was concerned. I told him, I got 4 months left. I'll take my chances. That's what I did. I have spent a good deal of my adult life wishing I had had the courage to take him up on it, because by then, although once again I couldn't articulate it clearly, I knew what I was doing was wrong. We were not helping the Vietnamese. We were not winning anything. This was crazy. But I just wanted to get the hell out of there in one piece. And then I started college in the September of 69, and I went all the way through the first year of college. All this while, I'm telling myself, I don't know what the hell's going on over there, but I'm out of it. I got all 10 fingers and all 10 toes, and it ain't my problem anymore. Meanwhile, I'm engaged in incredibly self-destructive behavior, drinking and driving. When I got to college, I add drugs to that mix. And then the Ohio National Guard murdered 4 kids, just like the kids I'm going to school with, Kent State University, and that hit me like a ton of bricks. I don't know when I finally decided this war is wrong, but I know when I decided to join the anti-war movement, and that was May the 3rd, 1970. Now, at that point, I thought, you know, that somehow, you know, we really meant well. We were trying to help the Vietnamese. We just did, somehow something had gone terribly wrong, but we were really good people. And I then spent the next year speaking out against the war, but not speaking out against the people who sent us there. And then the Pentagon Papers hit the streets in June of 71, and I read the whole freaking thing, every piece I could get my hands on, and then I realized this was no mistake.
Yeah.
This was 25 years of deliberate lies and half-truths and deception, and at that point, I've been angry ever since.
Yeah.
Okay.
Nothing else of interest in the world today?
Yes, sir. Very significant. This goddamn New York Times expose of the most highly classified documents of the war.
Oh, that. I see. That. I didn't read the story, but you mean that was leaked out of the Pentagon?
Sir, the whole study that was done for McNamara and then carried on after McNamara left by Clifford and the Peaceniks over there. This is a devastating security breach of the greatest magnitude of anything I've
seen. Well, I just start right at the top and fire some people. I mean, whatever department it came out of, I'd fire the top guy.
Yes, sir. Well, I'm sure it came from defense, and I'm sure.
Well, I want to go back to your early months in Vietnam, because and dwell just a little bit on, you know, what you've described there is quite a rapid shift from, you know, showing up with the John Wayne story, expecting to be greeted with flowers and you know, as a liberator of the people of Vietnam, to going quite quickly to, you know, even contemplate any way to get the hell out. You know, you mentioned the incident in which you witnessed Vietnamese detainees just being horribly abused, but, you know, what else sort of caused you to, you know, just shatter that whole story that you had told in the editorial about what you were going there to do?
Let me start by saying you had said in such a short transition, 4 months in a war zone is not a short time.
Okay.
It's forever. Mm. It's a long time, and day in and day out, we would run. I remember at one point we got sniped at from a village, and I ended up spending a lot of time with the battalion scouts because they came under the S2 section, and my boss discovered I was a pretty good field marine. The irony of all that is I was supposed to be an air wing clerk, and I ended up in the freaking rice field. Anyway, that was my doing, being a young, dumb kid. You know, I remember one time we got sniped at from a village, and we called in an airstrike and Napalm DeVille. It was just stuff like that, day in and day out. And it was perfectly clear the whole time. The first 8 months I was in Vietnam, our battalion, which was about 1,000 men, encountered on average, on a monthly average, 75 mining and sniping incidents. Most of them were mines and booby traps, overwhelming amount. Over half of those incidents resulting in Marine casualties, dead and wounded men. And we're operating in a heavily civilian populated area, rice farming and fishing. Our boys are stepping on these booby traps and mines all over the damn place. The Vietnamese civilian pop, they're not stepping on them. They're not getting blown up. It's just us. How come they're not getting blown up? Oh, well, they must know where these mines are. Well, why won't they tell us? We're supposed to be helping. Wait, they might be planning the goddamn things. They're probably the ones that. And so the next time you're out on a patrol and somebody steps on a mine and ends up dead, and there's Joe Blow, Farmer Jones, out in the rice field with his water buffalo, and he doesn't even behave like he heard the explosion, and you just sight in on him and blow him away. Fuck you, Jack. Stuff like that. Day in and day out, and day in and day out. You patrol the same villages every single day for 8 months, and nothing changes, and you don't see any armed soldiers. I saw like 8 armed guerrillas the entire first 8 months I was there, if it was even 8 of them. Hmm. Nobody to fight back at. Your pals are getting killed and maimed every single day, and there's no one to fight. Just an explosion, and you got guys lying on the ground screaming for their mothers, and there's no one to fight. But it makes you crazy, man. Oh. It makes you crazy. I never saw anything on the scale of a My Lai massacre, but I understand why some of those men did that. It's just, it was an impossible situation. And that, of course, is what at some point I hope you and I are going to talk about, is that it was an impossible situation. I mean, what were a bunch of scared kids with guns supposed to do?
Yeah.
Not like these folks were inviting us to dinner.
Because,
and it became perfectly clear that they, you know, the pitch was that the Vietnamese civilians were forced to help the Viet Cong. Jesus, no, not at all. I mean, we forced them to choose between the VC and the Americans. And that was no choice at all. All you had to do is send a Marine patrol through a village, and the VC had all the recruits they ever needed. That simple. The longer we stayed, I had an Arvin sergeant, a guy that was assigned to our battalion as an interpreter, was assigned to the S2 section. A very intelligent man. He was an enlisted guy, had been drafted into the Saigon Army when he was 18 years old. He was at 24 at this point. He spoke English and French and Chinese. And he had been born in the north. I mean, it's a hell of a story, but this guy was one of the bravest men I'd ever encountered. And he was not fond of the communists, but at one point in September of 67, he walked into our battalion command post and basically he quit, says, "I'm not doing this anymore. I quit. You Americans come here with your tanks and your guns and your helicopters and your arrogance, and everywhere you go, the Viet Cong grow like new rice in the fields." And I remember that phrase, "Everywhere you go, the Viet Cong grow like new rice in the fields. You are destroying my country, and I'm not going to help you anymore." And he quit. They put him under house arrest, and the next day, an Arvin major and a couple of privates came and took him away. And if they didn't put him up against the wall and shoot him, they probably sent him to some suicide battalion. That happened about a month before I went to Hong Kong on my R&R, and that was hanging on my head because I knew that Sergeant Sung was not a coward.
Yeah. Is this Trin from your
book? Yeah. Yeah, I made up names for these guys, and I never remember the fake names. The last thing I did.
Yeah.
In fact, if you read the book, you'll read about Sergeant Wilson, Sergeant Wilson, Sergeant Wilson, Sergeant Ward, Sergeant Wilson, Sergeant Wilson. The last thing I did was change the names in the manuscript, and there's a place I missed.
Oh.
And Sergeant Wilson is really Sergeant Ward.
Yeah.
And I forgot to change it. I missed it. So that's there in the book.
Yeah. I wanted to check because you had the incredible scene of the kind of argument where he has this outburst where he says, you know, "You don't know what you're doing. You're ruining everything. You're hypocrites. You're fools. You're giving my country to the communists. You need to take your ignorance and go home." What struck me when I read that as well, though, was, you know, your reaction to him was, in part, you know, kind of insulted to say, you know, we're here at the time, you know, we're here to help you.
Yeah.
You know, how dare
yeah.
you, you know?
Well, remember, I'm 18 years old. What you're looking at is the destruction of everything you've ever believed about the world you live in and the country you live in and the person you are. All of it destroyed. It's hard to let that go. And what you're seeing there in my reaction to Sergeant Sung was, I'm still struggling with, is this really happening? Is this really what I'm doing here? That's what it is. You know, ultimately, I did, within a few years, realize, everything. I had made a terrible, terrible, terrible decision, and it would haunt me for the rest of my life. I have never felt comfortable in the country of my birth since 1968. I'm here. I'm an American. I can't deny it. Where the hell am I going to go? But I'm very uncomfortable being an American. I am more often ashamed of myself and my country then I feel good. I mean, it's just, and it has a lot to do with, you know, what I was told as a child. I gather that all you were, though you weren't born in this country, you were raised in this country. You know, all the stuff that we were told is was all mythology. It had nothing to do with who and what this country really is. And of course, this whole, it's still going on, of course, with this critical race theory. It's not critical race theory. It's called history.
Yeah.
That's what it is. It's history.
Yeah.
And and people are still, you know, they can't come to terms with it. We're not the most evil nation on earth, but we're also not, we're, you know, this American exceptionalism. Hell, the British thought they were exceptional, and the French thought they were exceptional, and the freaking Chinese thought they were exceptional 2,000 years ago. It's just what powerful nations do.
This concludes part one of our interview with Dr. W.D. Earhart, Vietnam veteran, poet, scholar, and teacher. Thanks for listening, and we hope you'll join us for part two.